Good afternoon and welcome to the Paige Turner Show here on KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM, and also streamed at kyrs.org. I'm Anna Jay, and I am your host of the Paige Turner Show, where we talk about reading, writing, and love of the written word. We are broadcasting from the third floor of the Central Library in Spokane, Washington, and it's a beautiful, hot, sunny day. Well, I can't say beautiful. It's a hot, sunny day here in Spokane, and lots of things going on, but the worst thing is we've got some smoke coming in that we're blaming our Canadian friends for, and so I can't believe it's really in the Spokane area pretty strong today, and it's coming from up in the Bonner's Ferry area. So anyway, but we make do. So today my guest is Catherine Robinson. She just published a new novel called Under the Tree Ferns. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here. You've had such interesting, distinguished people on this show. I'm honored to be among them.
Whoa, that's a nice compliment and stuff.
That's true.
Yeah, I am. I was thinking about all the different shows that that I've done, and I am also very blessed that here in Spokane we have a really strong literary population.
Yes.
We have lots of authors that, of course, most people immediately think of Jess Walters if they think of Spokane, but they have so many others. Sharma Shields, in fact, is going to be publishing a new book really soon. And but also I found, and you might have found this too, that the authors in Spokane are very supportive of their fellow authors.
Yes, I've talked with Sharma several times through the library, and she's been so helpful. And enthusiastic when I was more nervous than enthusiastic. And so
yeah.
it was great to have her. And I first heard of Jess Walter when somebody from far away said, oh, you know, there's this well-known writer in Spokane. And so he's known far and wide. And
he is.
I've met him.
It's funny. I was like on some cruise going through Canada one time or something around Canada. We went from, I think, Toronto to New York City or something. I forgot. But anyway, there was somebody on the cruise and I was talking to him. I said I did a radio talk show of authors in Spokane. And then he said it right away. He said, oh, see, I've had Jess Walters on your show. And so,
yes.
Actually, Jess Walters has never been on the show. His brother, Ralph, who's the spokesman editor, has been on the show, but just when I used to talk, I taught for North Idaho College, so when a novel takes place in Coeur d'Alene,
yes,
some of the spots and stuff, we were talking before we got on the air that people kind of kept saying, well, you can't have that there, they say.
Right. Pamela Palmer is one of the narrators in the book decades after the incident that brings together the whole novel, and I put her in a high rise downtown. I put her at Sherman Beach, isn't it? And that where you couldn't see the downtown lights. And finally, I put her along the beach by the Coeur d'Alene Park.
Yeah.
And I could still tell you which house I chose for her.
So I was just going to mention, though, when I taught Jess, often came and was a guest lecturer in my classes. I taught media literacy, and he came and talked about being a published author. And then he did one of his first books was on Ruby Ridge and the standoff on Ruby Ridge.
And
he came and did a couple of shows with me on Idaho Public Radio and stuff. That was very fun. But he's so generous to our...
Well, and he's an amazing speaker. I mean,
he is. He's funny. And
yes.
Yeah, he's funny and stuff. So so back to your book. So we're name dropping here at Coeur d'Alene, Puerto Rico or whatever. So what's your background?
Well, I grew up in New Jersey, and then I moved to Tucson, Arizona for a year or so just to go somewhere different, and I wound up getting a master's in teaching English as a second language. And the university there said, no, they don't hire students from the university, and a friend who was of Puerto Rican background saw these different positions at the University of Puerto Rico So I applied. I got the job. I was the first in my class to get a job. And off I went to Puerto Rico for just a year or two.
Yeah.
I wound up leaving 40 years later.
I think that's amazing. You know, the other little interesting tidbit, and I don't know if it's true, there's a lot of people in the Northwest that are ESL teachers. And the one time when somebody from Japan said that they liked ESL teachers from the Northwest because we don't have an accent.
Huh. Well, if I have an accent, it may be New Jersey, but, you know, it's not a strong one, or Western Pennsylvania, yeah, because that's where my parents came from. I know I say certain words like coffee, I think people. And
soda pop.
Different things like that, but it's an interesting comment.
I think it's, too, that the Northwest, like California, Oregon, we have more voices like the newscasters, like the ones that are on TV. And so that's, you know,
right,
because you hear often, and you've probably heard, and because you've taught it for several years, that many people learn English from watching American television.
Yeah. Very true. In Puerto Rico, it's amazing,
yeah,
how many people were very fluent. And
oh,
I
yeah
said, have you lived in the States? And No, I watch TV. I was like, whoa.
I often tell the story. We were over in Belgium bicycling, and we got lost. And this young woman and a young girl, she must have been only about 10, and she was on her bicycle. So we asked if she could tell us how to get to this particular place. And she said she couldn't tell us, but she could just ride with us and take us there. And so we said, are you sure you're okay with, you know, your parents like going off with these American strangers? And she said, oh, I want to practice my English. And so we asked her if she learned her English in school. And she said, no, she learned it from watching American soap operas. And she'd
exactly
watched like Days of Our Lives or something. And then she asked us if, she said, does Rachel die? That's funny. So you were there for 40 years, and but during that time you taught.
Yes.
But then you also did freelance writing.
Right. For a while I did both. I heard about an offer to write about places on the island for the English language San Juan Star magazine, and I had a friend that convinced me to do that. At that point, I still liked to write fiction stories and such. And he said, well, writing is writing. You know, you can put all the fiction elements into your writing, make it as good as you can. And so I said, okay, I'll do that. And I did two times a month, I would present these articles on different places around the island. Eventually, I put them into a book, The Other Puerto Rico, and then that led to more work because people knew me as a travel writer. And then I had a friend who said, well, let's do a book about the rainforest, a guidebook, because there wasn't any guidebook. And I said, fine, because I love to hike in the forest. It's a beautiful, magical place. But then he left the island, and I continued on, but I thought there's so much about it. It's the only tropical national forest in the U.S. national forest system, and it has had decades of studies about plants, animals, everything. And so I gathered it up. I kind of think of it as, I don't know, John McPhee, who wrote a book, The Pine Barrens, mm-hmm, and I grew up in New Jersey and never went to the Pine Barrens. It was something, when you went to the Jersey Shore, it was on the other side, but you never went to it. And he wrote about all aspects of it, and I thought that was fascinating. And so when I got to El Yunque, the rainforest, I decided to do a book that covered as much as I could, mm-hmm, put into it, and then that came out, I think, in 97, and after that is when I thought, let's try fiction again, maybe a book.
Yeah, that's it. And two, I mean, is that one of the ones that went into a documentary?
Well, Yes, because I wrote the book that I became known for knowing about El Yunque, and I had a friend or a woman who asked me to work with her on this documentary about the forest that they put in the visitor center. You know, when you get mm-hmm. in, you can watch the movie. And it did win an award, mm-hmm. Suncoast Emmy, for nature writing. And so it was neat. It was a great experience, a great feeling. And she was excellent to work with. You know, I was proud to be part of that group. But El Yunque has the forest that has been giving and giving and giving right. to me through a variety of things. And
because you mentioned earlier too about writing like fiction versus nonfiction, and the Sean Bessel, who is also a well-known author here in Spokane, used to do. He wrote for the newspaper for years as the editorial writer.
Right. And, yes, I read.
Yeah, and he's also one of the teachers in the Eastern's Fine Art Program for creative writing. But he always mentions too about how he loves writing fiction because you don't have to tell the truth all the time.
Well,
yeah, he said there's no fact checking.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. And in fact, the writer who encouraged me to be very creative in my nonfiction, he wrote for The New Yorker and eventually got in a little trouble because he fictionalized a couple of things, and The New Yorker was very strict on fact-checking. So
yeah. Did it too? Because, too, we mentioned earlier that you did that, you know, when Voice Palmer, so when she is in Coeur d'Alene and then you had her, like, living in certain places that somebody said, no, she couldn't do right. that. That wouldn't be right because she couldn't see the lights and stuff. And so I just met with my book club yesterday on a particular book, and it was the same thing. It was not so much fact-checking, but we wouldn't believe, like, somebody, like, went over to Europe, this older lady, like, older, younger than Osprey. But anyway, she went to Europe, and she had a credit card. And when she got over there, the credit card wouldn't work. And that was when I right away said, who goes with only one credit card?
It's funny that you...
So you start doubting some of the things.
You can invent all kinds of stuff, but it needs to make sense, I think. Yeah. You know, even if you do science fiction or fantasy. But it all... There are certain things that have to make sense or you don't believe it any longer.
And, and then what it is, I think what happens is, you know, I call myself, you know, Mr. Spock. I'm always saying, that's not logical. That's not logical. Right. And so when you start, and I also use the example that when I used to teach, I was correcting papers and I found a misspelled word, then it became a treasure hunt. How many more misspelled words are you going to find in this paper? And so, and then you start kind of doubting things, or you, and so the same thing, like is when a reader starts reading something and it goes, that I was reading Coeur d'Alene and that wouldn't be true, then we start like critical about
right.
everything.
It takes you out of the flow. To me, the mm-hmm. most important thing, I love to write and I love to have it flow like a stream mm-hmm. gently going along. And if you have rocks in there that are disbelieved and the reader has to stop and say, well, wait a minute. You know, it's no longer flowing. And so I think the most important thing is that it just flows along gently.
And to you mentioned that to know that, and we're going to hear a little bit of your writing in just a minute here, but you're a very descriptive writer. But if the description too gets going too long, you know, we say, come
right.
on.
And that's what the critique group that I was in at Notice Orchards for many years, that's a lot of what I learned, and often kind of painfully, that, you know, it's an information dump. You're putting too much of that in. Mm-hmm. And if the reader's starting to say, well, okay, let's get back to the story, you've gone too long. And I eliminated a good amount of description because originally this book was 120,000 words.
Oh, wow.
Especially when you show... don't tell, which is what the critique group told me to do, then you really get a lot of words. And yet for a first book, a debut, they really don't want it over 100,000. So I had to cut and cut. And a lot of the descriptions went, but I hope I kept enough.
Yeah, because too, like I said, I read quite a bit, and it seems like the average novel is about 400 pages or less. And so, and that's when people even look at a book and it's like they go 700 pages. I don't think so.
No, unless you're a known writer. You know, Stephen King could write 700 pages and people will read it. I read something, his The Dark Tower, that was like 5,000 words, and the ending was horrific.
Yeah. The person who wrote The Help, Katie Stockett, I think is her name. Anyway, she has a new book out, The Calamity Club, and it's about 700 pages, but it's extremely good book, and it keeps you interested.
And she's known. This one is almost exactly 100,000 words, and it's under 400 pages, so...
So let's talk about, you've written this is your actually second novel. You wrote another fiction, didn't you?
This is the first, and this took the longest. I was saying 25 years, but when I did the math, it was really closer to 30 from the time I started it to this year. And then I joined that group, and I finished this one. But I liked the group because when I got to Spokane, I knew hardly anyone, and I wanted to stick with the group. But to do that, I had to start something else. So I wrote book number two, book number three, and I'm finishing book number four. Yeah. And then I felt you can't just keep writing. You've got to, you're not getting any younger. You've got to get some of these out. And then that's how I got this one out.
So you mentioned your critique club, and most every writer I've had on the show has a writer's group, whether it's a face-to-face writer's group or right now it's really popular to have the online writer's groups, because then you get kind of perspective from a lot of people in a lot of different areas. They don't have to come and stuff. And and somebody else said, and they tend to stay with it, but they're so loyal to their writers club. It's like one of my friends is a writer, and she said, I've got to get home because I've got to have my sample for tomorrow's writers group or I'm going to be in trouble. And stuff.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, you encourage, and it's great to have a deadline like that. Otherwise, you can say, tomorrow I'll do it tomorrow, But if you have a deadline, it really helps.
Yeah. So back to, let's talk about, are you considered yourself a daily writer? Do you write every day?
Well, I did, yes. I would get up and after breakfast, maybe around 8, 9, I would start writing, and I would write till 12, 1 o'clock. Okay. And then maybe again in the afternoon, or maybe I had to do other things. But once I'm almost done with this fourth one and I started working on publishing this, I no longer have that routine, and I miss it. I miss the routine itself of every day getting up and rereading what I wrote and then figuring out ways to say it better. I miss that a lot, but this is the other, publishing is the other side of writing.
I know. And going around and promoting the book, and it's on a sideline. You're going to be at Barnes & Noble at the Spokane Valley Mall tomorrow.
Yes, tomorrow.
What times are you out there?
At 11, 11 to 3.
11 to 3.
It's okay. The Barnes & Noble in the Valley, and this will be a first for me also. I was at one last week at Kindred and Company.
Wasn't it a regular festival or something?
It was a festival. There were about 17 writers, so there were a lot of writers. And now, tomorrow, I'll be the only writer.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
So, but it's exciting.
Are you considered yourself a plotter or a panster?
A what?
A plotter or a panster? Do you like plot out your kind of where the story is going, or do you sometimes go by the seat of your pants, meaning sometimes the characters take you in a different direction?
Definitely a plotter. I definitely like to go knowing what's going to happen, basically. But I have to say I'm often surprised by a little different tack it might take as I'm writing, and things that, you know, I don't know where they come from, you know, your inner self, God-given, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think probably all writers get that in some way, you uh-huh. know. So you go along. The one thing that I do, Stephen King, to mention, he wrote a book on writing, and he said, just keep writing, keep writing, mm-hmm. keep writing to get to the end. I cannot do that. I have to take everything and get it as close to perfect as I can before I move on. Otherwise, I feel it'll start to deteriorate and sag.
Oh, yeah.
So I am a plotter and a perfecter, or as, you know, I try to get it as perfect as it can before I continue onward. But I do get a lot of surprises along the way.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about the characters in your book in a minute here, because you have a lot of very colorful characters in this book that, you know, with unique personalities that could very easily run off on their own. You might say, this is what Eduardo was going to say or do, but Eduardo might have a different idea.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. And sometimes he has, and it surprises me. And they're all invented characters, but a couple of them were inspired by real characters. But some of them do remind me of certain people I know.
Because I might read a quote from your article that was in The Spokesman.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I can. I'll sing along here and try to find it. Oh, here it is. We're talking about characters, and then you did. This is a great quote when we talk about your characters, and it says, "It was like a love affair with the island that I layered in with the characters. None of the characters are real, but inevitably, you're going to get some of yourself into it by fleshing out those details."
Yes, and that's very true. And I realized that after I finished this, maybe in around 2016. And then put it on back burner, and then took it out a couple of years ago again and reread it. And it was like all these details about Puerto Rico. And I, oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Oh, yeah. And by the end of it, I was kind of homesick for Puerto Rico. It was just, you know, I loved being reminded of all those things.
Yeah.
And my daughter, one of my daughters, has finished the book, and you know, she felt the same way. Brought tears to her eyes.
It is a very unique, a very, very unique place. So character development. So you have, so how do you do character development? Do you have where you sound like a very detailed person? So you're going to have Eduardo, when we talk about three of the main characters,
right.
We have Eduardo, we have the police chief, and we have the priest. As I look at the kind of the priest,
right,
a little
in
bit
Puerto
of
Rico,
but I mean,
yes.
The priest is still a big character. So,
yes.
Do you like when you start writing? Do you like do kind of a note card that says Eduardo's a certain age, he's a certain height, he has brown eyes?
You know, those kinds of details, for me anyhow, kind of grow as you go along. You know, the first thing was the body of a dead woman is found in a Yunque rainforest. Who was she? Where'd she come from? That's how it all started. But, you know, you have to write more than that. And so, okay, who finds her? And it just, you know, a teenage boy. But in order to do everything I wanted to do with the body, the dead woman in the forest, a lot of time had to go by. And so then I realized, okay, let's put it in the 1940s. And then, that's World War II.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So let's find out, you know, what happened in Puerto Rico. And they had problems with German U-boats. And so it just kind of, you know, it's like a puzzle that you solve. Well, I got to do this, and if I do this, then I have to do that. And that's how the characters kind of develop.
So what we're kind of talking about, that would you, that one reading, would you do a reading from the book right now, if you could?
We were talking, you and I were talking earlier about, you know, introducing the dead body in the forest. So this kind of gives us an idea of the body. It's the police chief, some volunteers that pick up the body the day after the boy discovers it. And here they've gotten to the top of a ridge after dragging it up out of the forest. Carlitos picks up the lantern, illuminating the body of the dead woman. The two men stared in silence. In spite of her bent position, Moreno could tell she was tall. She wore a loose-fitting blouse, trousers once black but now faded to a dark gray, and the chunky boots men from the States wore when they worked in the forest. A piece of string gathered long brown hair into a loose ponytail. Though she seemed middle-aged, she had a slim body, lacking the excess pounds put on through maturity, bearing children, and eating generous portions of rice and beans. No middle-aged woman in the region looked this thin. No wedding band, no jewelry of any sort. Moreno nodded. "Ashes to ashes," Carlitos quoted. "Look at her face. Unprotected by bulky clothing, it showed the swift ravages of death in the tropics. Half-closed eyes had sunk into the sockets, and the skin radiated a greenish-blue cast in the lantern light. Several pale maggots wiggled out of the blouse collar. Moreno looked beyond the ravages. The face had been tanned and weathered before death, but beneath the clothing she would be pale, paler than the others on the ridge. The straight nose seemed too big for her face. Long black lashes fringed the sunken eyes. Her full mouth drooped slightly at the edges. Carlitos broke the silence. "Difficult to see it now, but I bet she was pretty when she was young." "Probably so," Moreno snorted. "But then we're all pretty when we're young and alive." He rubbed the fabric of the woman's trousers between his fingers and touched one of the boots. "She certainly wasn't from here." "American?" Carlitos asked. "I guess we're going to find out." Yeah. So that's our introduction to
the. Just a real quick little pause here. You're listening to the Paige Turner Show here on KRS Medical Expo Count 88.1 and 92.3 FM, and also streamed at KRS.org. And just on a side note, all of our shows are archived, and so if you missed a Paige Turner Show you want to hear, or you want somebody to listen to this Paige Turner Show, you can go to our archives and just go down and pick the show. And my shows are archived for about 8 weeks. The music shows that we have, we have some beautiful, wonderful music shows here, and they are archived just for 2 weeks because of copywriting and stuff. So just a little side note to what I'm talking about. I just saw this little blurb here that tonight here in the library, we are having Get Loud in the Library, which is a free concert. Starts at 7 o'clock. And it'll be nice because we're going to top it. We're on the third floor, nice air conditioning up here. And we have the Bedheads, they have the Wood Dusters, we have the Silly Boy and the Easy Sleazers. And so, and it is, again, it's a free concert with the doors open at 6:30. And tonight at 7, the music will start. So, the, anyway, so back to, and oh, I'm sorry. And we're talking with Catherine Robinson about her book, Under the Tree Ferns, which I'm sure obvious is going to be available at Barnes & Noble.
Yes. It's available in most of the local bookstores. I've checked. Auntie's has it, Jupiter's Eye, Barnes & Noble. Who am I forgetting? And then over in Post Falls at Kindred and Company, and in Coeur d'Alene at the Well-Read Moose. So all of those I know have it.
Is it available on Amazon too?
And yes, certainly.
Is it? There's an audio and ebook too, or
not an audio? There's an ebook. It's distributed through Simon & Schuster, so you can go through them and type it in and find it too. And then through them, they have Amazon and they have some other places. And then it's in, you know, as many of the local bookstores as I could.
Because I'm kind of intrigued with Simon & Schuster, but at the Exo Press, it's called She Writes.
Well, it's a hybrid press, She Writes Press, fairly well known, and they publish the book. You pay a large amount up front, and they do a lot of the work getting it in different places. When you get your royalties, you get a larger percentage than you would in a traditional press. You still pay a lot. You'll never get that back. But, they did a beautiful job. They're known for their covers, and the cover of this, you know, I really loved it. It really evokes the
rainforest. Because that's a big thing. Like, at the bookstores, they also talk about, you know, don't judge a book by a cover. But on the other hand, the cover attracts people.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I'm not thinking of his name right, but a local writer who does kind of fantasy stuff, and he published his own book at first, and then it became very popular, and so he got other people to take over. But he did an extensive guide to self-publishing, and he said cover is all important. You know, if you're going to spend extra money, spend it on the cover.
Yeah.
Travis Baldry.
I was going to say, it sounds like Travis Baldry, because his covers at his books are so cool. I just love it. There's one character that he has that reminds me of one of my dog friends. And so I look at that cover, I was like, oh, God, that's Luna. Anyway, so it's funny. Yeah, I was when you said that Travis, he's a really good writer. Yes. He also, you know, does his own, because he is also a professional reader.
Yes, listen to one of his books, you know, and he's great, but he warns people.
Most of the time, publishers don't want the author to do their own, but
well,
in his case,
they probably don't do it as well.
So, okay, so let's talk about your characters in the book. And in fact, it was funny. First, two things are funny. That when you said Juniper Eye, that's where my book club met yesterday.
Oh.
Juniper Eye has this great little kind of cove that easily holds like 7 people. And so we have found it is just one of the best places to go for a book club. Nobody has to clean their house, and we all know how to get there easily and stuff. Yeah. So we've been going there for our book club, and it's really worked out well.
If you want coffee or, you know, pastry or something.
It's just off of First and Washington down in that area. It's a cute little store and stuff. So the, so let's talk about your character, because yesterday when I was talking to my book club about your book, I said it has one of the most loved characters, Eduardo, and if you don't like this character, there's something wrong with you. He's the heart of gold. He has kind of this way of like thinking that you sometimes say, I can't think a 16-year-old would or a 17-year-old would think like this, you know. There's one thing that he said, hand me the book back. And so anyway, so how did you come up with Eduardo?
Well, again, somebody had to find that body, and it just seemed like a kid who went into the forest and loved the forest, and you know, what kind of a kid. Then we had to have some sort of conflict too, and so, okay, he's someone who, you know, he was going to, his mother was pushing him to go to the States to study after high school, and he was a shy kid, didn't want to do this. He was afraid to go. So in a way, the body of this woman who had done the opposite journey, who had come from the States and was for some reason in Puerto Rico, it kind of mirrored his possible upcoming trip. And then it turns out that his mother actually knew this woman. And so that he was shy and introverted, but he was also tremendously curious, bright kid. And so suddenly he wanted to have answers and he wanted to know things. And he worked with the local police chief, who was a character in himself.
Yeah. So, because there was one point, I can't seem to find it here, but his ability to read people, that he was really good at interviewing, because he was like certain things that people didn't say, and he wondered why they didn't say, he didn't ask them about it. But it says when he asked good questions, but why didn't Senor, I can't remember, avoid so many of them? Why didn't she want to answer so many questions?
Okay.
And so he seems to have a really good insight for reading people. And then in the same one, they talk about the Morrisons, who was supposed to be the woman that was killed. And then he said something about, I could understand why people didn't like the Morrisons. And because of the, there's a pretty definite class system in Puerto Rico. In the 40s, there was probably.
Right? Yes, in the 40s. The woman that he was speaking to there was of the very upper class. And they would have tend to have been more with the Spaniards because they were upper class when the Spaniards were there. And then after 1898, the U.S. came in. So they were not so keen on the Americans who came in. And that's kind of what he understood about that. But he also realized, he was a smart kid, and he realized that the woman wasn't telling him everything. And mm-hmm. it turns out she wasn't, but he found out.
Because it's also kind of interesting because how the police chief relied on him because he spoke both Spanish and English.
Right.
And the police chief, I just thought that was kind of interesting too, that the police chief didn't know very much English. And so he would take this boy on the different things with him to find out.
Right. And under different guises, because he didn't want to admit that it was the English. And Eduardo's mother also spoke English because she went to a private school that was English speaking. And then after the 40s, English was taught in the public schools. And then at a certain point, it wasn't. And so when I was there, and I was doing interviews primarily for El Yunque Rainforest, there would be older men who had worked in the forest, let's say during the CCC times, between the world wars. And they were so proud to have worked and to be able to speak to me in mm-hmm. English. You know, it was a great sense of pride. Then they stopped making it mandatory, became like another subject, not the bilingual. And you didn't get that as much anymore. But I still remember how proud those people were to talk to me in English.
So we're going to run out of time here in a minute. So we better focus on this story. Takes place in 1942, and then it takes place also, it goes up to 2012 into Coeur d'Alene.
Right.
So explain to our listeners how the Coeur d'Alene aspect became.
Well, I realized that there were certain things that Eduardo was not going to be able to know. So I realized I had to have another character and doing the math, you know, it was around 2012 that she was reminiscing about her years. And she lived in Puerto Rico for about 25 years and then eventually moved to Coeur d'Alene. And Coeur d'Alene, because I was living in Spokane now. So, you know, write what you know again. You know, I knew the rainforest, I knew Puerto Rico, and now I lived here. I chose Coeur d'Alene because at night you look at that lake and you have the sparkling lights. And if you squint, you can kind of feel you're back in the Caribbean. And so I said, yes, this is where she'll live.
That's it. The funny thing is, because in your interview, you talked about going over there at Christmas time. And Christmas time in Coeur d'Alene would not be anything like Christmas time in Puerto Rico.
Yes and no. It has the same magical lights, yeah. You know, and that's the thing, you know, Puerto Rico, the temperatures would be in the 70s, 80s, but there would be lights everywhere and Christmas decorations. And so if you avoid the fact that it's 50, 60 degrees colder here, you can kind of get the feel.
If you can close your eyes and, you know, have enough, you know, hot toddies at the Coeur d'Alene Resort and stuff. So when her characters develop, and then she finds out things that she was supposed to be related to Laura Morris.
Yes, she when she decided to go to Puerto Rico, she thought her parents would be thrilled that she got a master's degree and got a job. And instead they said, you can't go there. And that's when she found out that there was a family scandal that had happened. But of course that piqued her interest and she wanted to discover it. It took her a long time, but eventually she does.
Because Laura's father, Jack Morrison, is that right?
Yes.
Was there with the government, with the U.S. government.
Right.
And there was something that happened. I thought it was interesting, too, because now we always, like when we're reading books and the political stuff comes in, and somebody was, when Book Discretion, I was at the other day, and they said that they didn't like that they kind of put the political, but they said, you know, you almost had to, because it was the time that the book was, and this was even a current one, and if you didn't talk about politics where a bunch of professors are at a party or whatever, it would be odd. And so anyway, so the same thing but in this book you kind of emerged, and I thought it was very interesting that I can't remember if I get the party right, but he said that he would probably leave because if the Democrat became president or the Republican became president, then he'd have to leave.
Right. Well, that is very true. And, you know, there is, it's true most everywhere, but, you know, that if the governor changed, heads rolled all the way down incredibly far.
We've talked about, and so she comes and then she discovers things from the, Laura Morrison was also a photographer, and we're not going to give it a lot away in the story because we want people to buy the book, you know, and so the, a photographer, they learn things from the pictures, and because there's also the little subplot in here that Eduardo is adopted. He doesn't know who his adopted parents are, and so there's kind of the underline that it might have been Laura, might have been his mother and stuff. So there's actually too, I think when I talk about this book, you have lots of great little twists and turns and stuff where, you know, so it keeps the reader very interested in what they find out. But also what's interesting about your writing too is, and you're a very good writer, that it's that you have different points of views and how you were able to introduce those points of views, like the journals, the letters or whatever, or the pictures brought in a different, you know, and you kind of mentioned how would somebody know this stuff, and so is it when they found the letters or found the journal entries and stuff. So the we can't go on without, but the priest is also an interesting character.
Yes, and I mean, I liked him, and I wanted the priest to be a good character. And there is a church in Luquillo that does have the indigenous motifs and stuff. But of course, I invented the priest. But the priest also takes the journey from the States to Puerto Rico, and at first hates that he got shipped off to Puerto Rico, but then comes to be very grateful and to love the island. And he's a kind person. And so you had all these different cultural mm-hmm. kind of complications and challenges for these people. But he was I liked that character too. And I liked Eduardo, and I'm glad he led a nice life.
So as we're starting to wrap up here, so I wanted to find, what have you currently read? What books have you currently read that you would recommend to someone?
Well, I did actually think of that. We were talking about the nonfiction, and the nonfiction to me, John McPhee just did amazing things. He wrote a whole book on oranges, and then the Pine Barrens, which is in New Jersey where I grew up. And then I was thinking, well, if she asks me about fiction, what would I say? That's harder because it's such a broad topic. But I did think of Diane Setterfield, and she's a British writer. She wrote The 13th Tale. Once Upon a River. And I found them fascinating because they were mysteries, kind of literary mysteries, haunting, exotic. And I guess that's what I would like to write, that kind of thing, where it's, not a formulaic mystery, but it would have some different aspects to it. And I loved those books of hers. Mm-hmm. So I would recommend that, and it would be nice to aspire to that.
That, we all start. But you do have a couple more books. You have a couple more books ready to be published?
Or? I do. I have one. Pamela Palmer eventually goes down to Chile. And while there, she meets a woman who claims to be taken to time travel to places in the past. And her husband and doctor fears that she's had some kind of psychotic breakdown, and Pamela, who's visiting her daughter, gets involved. and so that's that story.
Oh, yeah, because the daughter's introduced in this book, kind of inserted that there's a strange relationship. She moves to Chile or somewhere, and they talk on the phone once a year type thing. Right. Yeah, yeah.
And eventually they kind of resolve, and so in the second book she goes down. Then in the third book, I sort of do time travel again, and Pamela Palmer makes a cameo appearance. Then the fourth book is pure fairy tale.
But it sounds like a good book. So.
Well, it's fun. It was fun. And I went to Valdivia, Chile for a month to research. That was great fun.
That's even funner. Yeah. That's great. So anyway, so thank you, Catherine, for being with us today. Again, we've been talking with Catherine Robinson about her new book, Under the Tree Ferns, and she's going to be at Barnes & Noble in the Valley tomorrow and stuff. So, and we were looking forward to your next books, too.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
It's been a pleasure. So coming up next week, we have Chantel Woodland, and she has written a book and published called Millie Has the Most Fun. And her work, she is a special ed teacher, and she has a special needs daughter, Millie. And so the story is about children and their parents and navigating autism. And so that'll be next week. Down the line, then I think it's the next week, we're going to have, in 2 weeks, we're going to have Cass Kibello. I really messed up his name. I'm sure he's a professor at Eastern Washington, or not Eastern Washington, but at Gonzaga University. No, maybe he's at Eastern. Sorry. I think he's at Eastern, my alma mater. And he has a thing called the Ethiopian Library Project, where he has started a from his country down in Ethiopia. He started a library and stuff. And he has a great story on how a couple of big organizations here in Spokane are backing that library, and so fun. And
sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it should be. Yeah. He talks about in his interview with the spokesman, he talked about having that we'd go to school in Ethiopian when he was like 10 or whatever, and only the teacher was the only one that had the textbook, and she would read it to him. And I was thinking in Guatemala it's the same thing, that there's like usually three textbooks for the classroom, and then they just pass it around, right. And that's how. And so the but he talked about how he got the teacher to let him take the textbook home, and he like spilled something on the textbook, and then she made him pay for the textbook, and it was like $2, and how hard that was to come up with the $2 and stuff. And so anyway, he sounds like a great storyteller, just like you.
Well, thank you very much.
So thank you again for joining us here on the Paige Turner Show, and we look forward to being with you next week.
Bye-bye.
KYRS highlights local arts and music in a dynamic fashion, which in turn creates jobs, grows area businesses, and lifts our region's profile. Help support KYRS by texting GiveKYRS to 44321. Thank you.
Hey, this is Josh from The Silent Comedy, and you're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.
KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. I think you know the routine because this is Rusty's Radio Funhouse. And I am your host, Rusty Lewis.
That's right.
Your clown prince of radio. If anyone has a problem with it, then don't tune in. But no, seriously, we do want you to tune in, even if I don't like the listener, but it's impossible for me to dislike any of my listeners and or followers. Are you out there? Good! I thought so. Yes, we have quite the helping of Nonstop Madness for all of you. Time for a triple helping of Danny Elfman's rock band, Oingo Boingo. Starting off with Weird Science, a song about creating the perfect living, breathing woman with mad scientist-like vibes on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio.